Accession number 27811, Major Richard Wilson, Rail 11. Now we're talking about the officers' mess. What was the actual sort of bar and drink, you know, and the that side of things? I mean, was it a stuffy mess in the sense of, or was it a hard drinking mess? What kind of a mess was it amongst the actual officers? I don't mean the building. I mean, yeah.
No. I think it was a very happy mess. I mean, what was a sort of day you'd come down to breakfast, which would be served to you and all the rest of it, go out, do your morning's work, come in about 12:45, probably have a drink. I don't think we had a bar. A lot of messes, and certainly today, they do have a bar. But in those days, I don't think we had a bar. A mess orderly would come along with a silver salver and ask you what it was that you wanted for a drink, and brought you back your drink, and then you signed a chitty, which then went towards your mess bill at the end of the month. At lunchtime, most officers would be in for lunch, even the married ones. And then you'd do your afternoon's work, and then come back in the evening and have dinner. But that would only be obviously the married officers weren't there at night. But as far as the Suffolk Regiment mess was concerned, it was a very good, friendly.
What level of drinking was there? I mean, you know, there's some hard drinking messes, there's some less hard drinking messes, some
I don't think there was no specific hard drinking. I suppose people might have had a pint of beer at lunchtime, and then in the evenings. I don't know. No, I wouldn't have said the Suffolk Regiment mess was a hard drinking mess at all.
So just social drinking within the context?
Ordinary social drinking. And then about once a month, of course, there'd be a dinner night.
Now, dinner night, what would that be like? What would the evening be like? How would it progress and start?
Dinner night, we all got into mess kit.
What would that be?
That consisted of in the Suffolk's case, a red and yellow monkey jacket, blue trousers, yellow waistcoat, and then of course the National Service subalterns wouldn't have been put to the expense of getting mess kit, and they would be in what in those days was called a number one dress, which was a blue uniform. Mess nights were also used for entertaining other units, headquarters. If the commanding officer wanted officially to entertain the brigadier, he could ask him to a mess night, and then there would probably be an invitation will go out to PMC and two officers of whatever other units one had. So it wasn't just purely internal entertainment.
Now, what was the pattern of the evening?
You went to the anteroom. There were pre-dinner drinks, which could possibly have just been sherry. I can't remember. We're going back to the sort of autocratic days. Anyhow, we drank for sort of, I don't know, half an hour or so. Then the band would strike up something or other, and in you went to dinner, probably a four-course dinner. Wine, band playing. It was a great occasion. It's one of the things I miss from the many years I've been out of the army is a dinner night, because it was ceremonial, if you like.
Would there be speeches from with
guests? Not necessarily, but there would be toasts. The loyal toast, certainly, and probably a toast to the Colonel in Chief, who in our case was Princess Margaret. So there would be two toasts at the end. Then we'd all go back to the anteroom. The band would play for a bit longer. They would leave, and then, got up to a lot of stupid games. And
mess games are quite well known. But tell us, what were the common games in the Suffolks, and how did they work?
I seem to remember there was a game where you were blindfolded and given a rolled up piece of paper, and two of you, I think, knelt opposite each other, and one called out, "Are you there, Moriarty?" And when he said yes, you had to try and get him over the head with your rolled up piece of paper. I mean, totally childish, but that was one. There would be silly things like trying to get round the anteroom without touching the floor. I'm afraid, yes, we looked at from the outside. Some of our behaviour probably was would have been looked at as being rather peculiar. And I certainly had one officer who, I think, his mess bill with paying for broken furniture was far greater than the drink that he consumed.
Were they still playing the old traditional games like high cockalorum?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's another one. I was trying to remember what.
How does that one work?
That, I think, you've got two people sort of lying down opposite each other, and they wrap their legs round. One wraps his legs round the other and tries to turn the chap over.
Mess rugby, the rougher games, because some of the games are very rough in some regiments. I mean, mess rugby can be, you know.
I don't know whether we had mess rugby. Can't remember that. These games and things probably went on. I mean, so, you know, if you had the brigadier to dinner, the brigadier has probably left by then. And the commanding officer's probably left. And it would have been basically the sort of bachelor lot who'd only got to stagger upstairs to their rooms rather than the marrieds.
Would the majors get involved?
Probably.
So it was sort of colonel above, probably away. Yeah.
I mean, I certainly can't, because we were still being commanded by Tiny Heel in Germany, and I certainly can't see him taking part in any of them. But I'm sure there was a major or two who did it. I think we had two majors living in the mess anyhow.
How did the officers get on to? I mean, was there a divide in the mess? I mean, were you expected as subalterns to keep quiet, and you know, or were you allowed to talk to in front of all two majors and above? Or what was the sort of etiquette of the mess etiquette?
I don't know. It's a I mean, obviously, you know, subalterns probably tended to, or subalterns and captains, you know, stick to subalterns and captains, and majors and, you know, etc. slightly on a higher plane. But I can't remember that ever being a particular problem. I think I probably chatted to anybody who was in the mess. I'd like to look on it as once you were in the mess, it was common ground. Oh yes, you still called a major if you were a subaltern or a captain. You still called him sir, but otherwise, I think we were. You know, I'd like to think we were on common ground.
Were there limitations on what you could and could talk about? Was there any of that old? I mean, were you allowed to talk shop?
Well, they always said you shouldn't talk. What was it? Sex, religion and politics, I think, were the three things that you shouldn't talk about. But I'm sure that if that any of those came up in conversation, they were talked about.
Would people talk about shop? I mean, about the job, or that considered bad?
Well, probably yes. That they probably wouldn't, because that everybody knew what everybody was doing, you know. Anyhow, and the last thing when you got into the mess, actually, was to, as it were, carry on with your outside life. So it probably more than nobody particularly wanted to.
Now, did you have any particular friends at this time, or other young subalterns or captains? Yeah.
Well, I like to think that I got on with everybody in the battalion. I don't think I had any. Particular chums. I respected the company commanders, and I had lots of friends, but I'm not sure any of them were a particular friend on that. I think that sort of comes much more, you tend to do that very much more after you've left. But the rest of the time, when you're actually there, you're all in it together, as it were.
Now, what happens next then? I mean, I'm not quite sure, how long you're at Wuppertal.
Well, I'm not quite sure how long. I think I was at Wuppertal. Well, there was one other thing that happened while we were at Wuppertal, that we had presentation of colours.
Now, tell me about that.
Each battalion has a set of colours. Queen's colour and the regimental colour. And this is, to put it in yeoman's terms, a large flag, and on it are all the battle honours that the regiment has been awarded since it was formed in 1685. But these colours eventually sort of wear out, and so there's a great parade when you're presented with new colours. And in fact, the old Suffolk colours were very old indeed. I can't remember when they were actually presented, but they were what's called the old 6-foot colours, whereas the modern colours are, I think, 4-foot. And these were very old colours. They'd been carried in the coronation parade in London, and during that during the coronation, it became very wet. There was an awful lot of rain, and they had awful problems with the old Suffolk colours because they were so old that they began to strip off the pikes. And I seem to remember that. Not that I was part of the colour party, but I believe they had to go into the crowd and to borrow safety pins and things to hold the colours up on the pikes, because with the weight of the rain and the oldness of the silk, it was just tearing off the pikes. So come 54 or 55, summer of 54 or 55, we had a presentation of colours, and this is a monumental parade. Personally, I absolutely loathed drill. I'm not made up to do drill, and although I became eventually virtually a professional adjutant, who is meant to be very good at his drill, one of the things that I probably failed was my drill. I find it very hard to keep in step, and I just hate it. But presentation of colours is a huge parade, very similar to what you see on horse guards at on the Queen's birthday parade, similar type thing, that the colours are marched down through the battalion lines, etc., etc. And this is a very big parade. I was actually made ADC to Princess Margaret for the day. I was absolutely terrified because even in those days she had quite a reputation, and one was told could be very difficult. Although on the day she was nothing but charming, and I really didn't have to do anything other than just sort of walk behind, and if she wanted something, I presume I had to go and get it, but I can't remember that she did. that, of course, was a big day in the life of the battalion, and there would have been many weeks beforehand of rehearsing for that parade.
Now, would you also have a parade to lodge up the old colours somewhere?
Yes, the old colours would be marked during the parade. The old colours would be marched off for the final time, and then at some stage in the future, there would have been a service somewhere to lay up the old colours. And in our case, I'm pretty sure they're laid up in the Suffolk Regimental Chapel, which is in St Mary's Church in Bury St Edmunds. And I think if you went into the Regimental Chapel today, you'd find those colours still hanging up there. But that was a big, you know, a big day in the life of battalion.
Now, was there any? I mean, that's a big day in the Suffolk Regiment, all the rest of it. Was there any signs or of imminent changes in the regiment? Because you were going, they were all going to be forming the East Anglia.
No, not yet.
So at that time, it was still.
This was too early. We didn't amalgamate till 59.
So there's no sign in the wind of that?
There was no sign in the wind of that. Well, if there was, it was totally unknown to anybody other than possibly the commanding officer. But I don't believe there was, because I think it was too far in the future.
So what else happened at Wuppertal?
Well, I can't remember anything very much more happening in Wuppertal. I mean, I left the battalion, and the battalion continued on for about another 3 years, I think. I think in 1957 they went to Cyprus.
Now, why did you leave, and what year?
I left, it must have been 55, mid-55. I left to go and be adjutant to the depot in Bury St Edmunds.
So, that's in which barracks?
That was in Gibraltar Barracks, which was an old Victorian barracks, of which there's nothing left now except the keep. The commanding officer there was Major Charles Boycott, and he. I don't know whether he'd ever met me, but I mean, normally a commanding officer asks for his adjutant, because it's a very close working relationship between CO and his, as it were, principal staff officer. But I don't think I'd probably had ever met him, but I suppose, I know, somebody must have put in a good word for me or something, because it was. To be adjutant was considered to be, you know, quite a good job for a young officer to get. In fact, I mean, eventually I was adjutant of the TA battalion, of the 1st battalion, and I probably did too many years of it. But
At this time, though, you were just adjutant of the depot.
Yeah, I was just adjutant of the...
At that time, you didn't take the TA battalion there?
No. At that time, I was purely adjutant of the depot, which was responsible for training all the national servicemen, putting them through their 8 weeks, 16 weeks, or whatever it was, training, and then sending them out to the 1st Battalion. But I didn't actually have anything to do with the training. My job was, in present day terms, chief executive of the depot.
Now, so what was a typical day's duties like for you as adjutant there?
Well, it was a totally office bound job. I suppose, I don't know, I probably went into the office about, I don't know, 8:45, something like that. Spent the morning there, went up to the depot mess for lunch. In the afternoon, office bound again. Although I'm a great believer of getting out and seeing everything that's going on within your sort of responsibility. So I would, if there was troops on the range, I would endeavour to get out, just go and visit them. If there were troops out on exercising, I would endeavour to go out and visit them. Just to chat to the platoon commanders and people and see what their problems were. You know, often it would be I hadn't been given enough time to get out to the ranges or whatever it was. Big problems to them, but something that often was you could come back and put right straight away. So it was important to know what, you know, what was going on in one's domain. And that, I mean, it's very difficult to tell you very much more about than my next 2 years. I mean, that was it. There, I had two commanding officers, Charles Boycott and Johnny Calder.
So now, what were they like?
Well, both, I think, had been in, had got war service. Charles certainly had, and I think Johnny had as well.
Both majors?
Both majors, yes. They had families that I was still a bachelor then. They had families that I got on very well with. Their married quarter was on the end of the mess, so I saw a great deal of them. And in fact, Johnny Calder's son, who I remember going off to school in his shorts and the rest of it, is now a retired brigadier. So that shows how time has gone on. But nothing very exciting.
No trouble in your relationship. I mean, as you said, it was an important relationship, but you had no trouble.
No, I like both men. To be an adjutant to a CO that you didn't like would be very nearly impossible, because you would be hypocritical if you were in that sort of situation. I liked both of them, and I got on with their wives very well. And their family, and I think that is important, because a depot mess is very much a regimental family mess. You see an enormous amount of people because everybody comes through the depot. If there's a posting, the chap probably comes through the depot at some stage. New subalterns joining from Sandhurst and Eaton Hall all came through the depot. So there was a terrific sort of throughput and enabled one actually to get to know an awful lot of the officers in the regiment who one had heard about but never actually met, which sometimes was helpful. But otherwise, no, it was just an office job, really.
And that was 55 to?
That was 55 to 57.
And what then?
About mid 57, I was posted back to the 1st Battalion, which was in Cyprus.
Whereabouts in Cyprus?
Well, at that stage, they were just outside Nicosia, in a tented, a large tented camp between the airport and the town of Nicosia itself.
Now, I should have asked you, what about your journey out there? Because did you fly?
I flew. The first time I'd ever flown in a large aircraft. I can't. I think yes, it was Monarch Airlines. Monarch used to do all the trooping and the rest of it, and it must have been. It was a propeller-driven aeroplane, something like a Britannia or a DC-4, I think, or something like that. But it was a first experience for me. I'd never. I had flown in smaller aircraft in Austers and things like that, but I'd never flown in a big plane. So it was quite an exhilarating experience, especially as one sort of flew in over Cyprus and you could see it from the air where presumably one would be operating.
Now, what was the situation when you joined the unit at Nicosia? I presume you landed at Nicosia Airfield.
We landed at Nicosia Airport, and there must have been very tight security and all the rest of it, and one would have been met by the duty officer or whatever it was, taken down back to the mess, which I think the mess itself I think actually was a brick building, but of course all our accommodation was tents. We lived in tents. I think we did have a tent as officers. I think we had a tent to ourselves, and the men were four to a tent or whatever it was, something like that.
What was it like living in tents?
I think I arrived in midsummer, so it was very hot. And then you used to have these sort of wind squalls which would pick up all the sand and throw it in every direction. So often it was difficult to keep the place clean. I mean, we had beds and the like. I mean, we weren't sleeping on the floor or anything like that. So we'd have a bed and a locker and the rest of it. But there wasn't any running water, etc., in the tent for one's ablutions. You went up to a sort of tin shack, which did have some running water, and shaved and. And we must have had showers. There were showers, and then for other things, there was some deep trench latrines, which were pretty horrific.
What were they like?
Well, these were just a sort of thunder box over a huge hole in the ground, and as you can imagine, they were pretty smelly. I believe there were one of. I think it produces quite a lot of methane gas, and there were one or two occasions I think when somebody has probably dropped a cigarette down the hole and probably left the DTL rather quicker than they'd gone in. But I believe that did happen on one or two occasions. But no, they were.
But you were in an enclosure, as thunderbox as they call it, above the trench. So
that's right. Yes.
I mean, you sat on a seat and it just sort of went through to a ditch.
Yeah. It wasn't like the poor chaps in Gallipoli who were lodging over a log laid across a pit, which must have been ghastly. But no, there was a thunderbox to sit on and etc. But it. I doubt whether they'd pass health and safety regulations today.